year this week's album debuted, last week's album was blowing up the charts. And for our astute listeners, that's all the hints you needed. For the rest of us, myself included, this year also saw the founding of Motown Records. Walt Disney released Sleeping Beauty, and finally, this year also featured The Day the Music Died, when the Beechcraft Bonanza carrying Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and J.P. Richardson's crashed in an Iowa cornfield. Today's artist had 9 siblings, was a Native American, and one of the original Rhinestone Cowboys. The year was 1959, and the artist is Country Music Hall of Famer Marty Robbins. The album, Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs, today on Two Dudes and Tunes. Welcome to Two Dudes and Tunes, the show where Wood and Chris often have opposing views and yet still enjoy a strong friendship, despite what some of you may think in the reviews. Chris, tell me, what's the secret ingredient for our success?
Well, Wood, I think the secret ingredient to our success is what most people probably lean on a little bit too much, a good alcoholic drink. It's the social lubricant that makes this this thing go. I am drinking a sangria that my lovely wife made for the 4th of July. It's delicious. It's sweet and tart, and it's ice cold. What are you drinking today?
I'm drinking a man's drink, brown water.
Just brown water? Is there something wrong with your plumbing?
There probably is, but we don't want to talk about that. No, I am drinking 36 Revolver from a distillery called Ranger Creek here in San Antonio. So it's a suburban, and it is delightful. Nice. So virtual cheers to you, my friend.
And virtual cheers to you.
And to be fair, there is a place and a time for sangria, and right about now sounds about right. So
yeah, if it's hot outside, and it is, oh man. It is so refreshing. Well, how's your week going, man? How are things?
Oh, I'm, just getting back in the saddle. See what I did there? I'm really proud of that.
I did. I noticed. you also fired your 6 guns in the air several times. We had to edit that out.
Yeah, they peaked the mic a little too hard, and I'm going to have to replaster the ceiling. No, seriously, though, I'm planning some regional trips for work. I manage about 6 states worth of maintenance and repair for vehicles. And so I get to go to places like the wonderful city of El Paso, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point tonight.
We better.
In addition to like St. Louis, Missouri, that's about the breadth of my territory. So getting ready for that is taking up a lot of my time.
Yeah, you're going to all the like great old West haunts.
Kansas City, Little Rock. I mean, we're basically doing both the Pony Express and the Cattle Trail.
Oh man, 2 for 1. Hopefully,
and Dallas. I mean, come on, how many more can I do?
Hopefully, they're paying you some good money to be going through the Indian territories. It can be dangerous out there.
We pay by the mile. What's new with you, man?
Well, not a whole lot. I got the garage organized this past weekend, and like I'm kind of a fiend for organization. Like it's one of my favorite things. And so I was like out there feverishly working and putting pegs and like hooks and pegboard and shoving stuff where it needs to go and putting up plastic shelves and stuff. So I was in like an organizational fugue state on Saturday, and it was fantastic. I woke up with an organizational hangover on Sunday. I mean,
you and I are birds of a feather when it comes to organizational, like OCD.
Oh, it's so nice.
And I love, this is going to sound really bad, I really love Tiffany. She's an amazing person, but she's not an organizationally OCD person. And so we had a little bit of an argument this weekend over, I stayed home for 4th of July weekend and was cleaning our kitchen. And one of the tasks that I assigned myself was that I was going to get our pantry organized. Mm-hmm. And our pantry just collects stuff. It's got you know, waffle makers that we never use and a cotton candy machine and a pizza rotisserie thing that sure ever worked, like all that. And then all the other stuff. And it just piles up.
Uh-huh.
And so on Sunday, an Amazon package arrived and it was a label maker. And she asked, what's the label maker for?
And you said, what isn't it for?
Exactly.
Labels everywhere.
I was like, well, I'm going to label everything in the pantry and where it goes. So everything has a spot. And she was like, excuse me?
I love it.
But we worked through that after many hours of marriage counseling, and I returned the label maker. No, not seriously. I still have it.
good. I think, and this might paint us in a bad light. I think we're a couple of Monicas, to be honest with you.
That's a reference I get, and yes, we definitely are.
Oh, man. Like, I'm not as competitive as Monica, but her, like, frenzied cleaning of things and like the joy she takes in clean organization. I'm just like, game recognized game. I feel you on that.
Well, and the thing is, I would label things on like tape, except I hate my handwriting. I don't want to stare at my own handwriting telling me where to put things. So I was like, nah, we're getting a label maker and we're putting it in Arial bold.
Yes. Love it. Can't love it. You know what, Tiffany, if you're listening, what you need to do to get back at Wood is to label everything with Comic Sans. Go through and tear off all the Arial labels and use Comic Sans or Papyrus if you really want to be cruel.
Nah, just ignore the labels.
just don't use them.
Anarchy, man, anarchy.
Man. Well, so yeah, getting the garage organized was a lot of fun. And then the other thing that is maybe not as weird for a 30 something year old white male to be super into is I've been really enjoying video games, as they say. But I've been playing this game Injustice 2 because my younger brother really loves it, and he took a job a few months ago now in Nebraska. And so obviously we can't get together and play, but he really likes that game. And so I went out and bought it. And it's like a 2D fighting game, you know, like Tekken or Mortal Kombat or whatever, but it's all DC characters. And it's a lot of fun. It's one of those, like the plot line of it is that Superman goes, you know, like, bad, I guess. And so that, you know, like the plot doesn't really matter as much. It's just more about the beat 'em ups. And so
it's like been the getting plot line to Super Smash Brothers. There is no real plot.
Like there are some scenes strung together, but mainly it's just beat the crap out of this guy. Okay, now beat the crap out of this guy.
Don't go. And that's been rogue.
A lot of fun. Yeah. Well, is anything else happening? I guess you're just gearing up for going to El Paso. Is there anything else you want to mention before we get going on today's episode?
No, I think we should get into it. We've spent about 10 minutes on small talk, so I think it's time dive into Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs, Marty Robbins, September of 1959.
All right, Wood, so sing me some Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs. Where did this album ride into your life from?
You know, this is one of those LPs that my parents had when I was a little kid. My dad didn't get a record player or a CD player until the mid-90s, and so he was still living that LP life up until that point.
Wow.
And this album came to him by way of my mother's dad, my Papa Jack. Mm-hmm. Papa Jack was this guy who... he collected all sorts of stuff, and then he made like a living in retirement by selling things out of storage units. But the one thing he would not sell was LPs. He collected LPs, and he would have 20 of an LP, but he'd still be collecting them. And so I remember as a kid, him having these floor to ceiling bookshelves in their two car garage that was literally like the records room of like where they put the Ark of the Covenant at the end of Indiana Jones.
I love it.
And it was all just LPs, alphabetized and meticulously organized.
Oh by, man, like, speaking of organization, oh, heck yes.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I, unfortunately, I didn't appreciate it as much as a kid. And now as an adult, I'm like, man, this took him years.
Yep.
But he loved this album. So his record player set up in his living room was right next to their TV. And he had a little like flippy deal that could hold maybe 25 albums on it. Mm-hmm. And this album and its bright pink artwork with Marty Robbins drawing a six gun on somebody was always towards the front of that stack in that flippy thing. And we went to his house for years and it was always there because it was just on his constant rotation. He'd go out there to the garage and find something he wanted to listen to. But those 10 or 20 albums in his living room were the ones that he came to the most often. And at some point or another, my dad ended up with a copy of this album. And I remember listening to it in our home in Reno before we moved here to San Antonio when I was six.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then I also remember listening to this album driving back to Fallon, Nevada, where Papa Jack lived until he passed away about 5 years ago. And I remember listening to this on cassette tape, driving into El Paso at like 3 a.m. in September, because my parents did the whole get off work and then drive to Fallon at night so that the kids would sleep the most of the way.
Oh, that's smart, actually. Very clever.
And I remember, because we'd wake up about Phoenix. So it was, you made a lot of progress before you had to stop, you know?
I like it. I like
it. And I remember distinctly waking up one night at about 3 a.m. with just this malodorous joy of bovine excrement is the only way you could say it. Oh. Like, it was in the middle of like the cattle season and there was this huge slaughter yard outside of El Paso. And it just, it reeked for 60 miles. I mean, coming to and then leaving, it was just horrible. And I remember this album playing during that portion of the drive and distinctly the full length version of El Paso playing as we rolled into El Paso and my dad going, how fitting. It's as if somebody planned this.
Oh, I love it. So whenever you hear this album, your nose crinkles up and you like gag a little bit. How did it make it onto your list, if that's the case?
I'm going to talk about that a little bit later on why it made the list, but that's one of my earliest memories of it. Let's say that. That's how it came into my life. That's not how it is remembered.
Gotcha. Good, good. Also, it sounds to me like maybe y'all overshot El Paso and just drove straight on to Lubbock, because there are some days out here where it is just rank and vile.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't open the doors or go outside because it is terrible.
Having family and property up in Lubbock, I know exactly what you're talking about. It's,
you know,
it's a special time of year when it comes around.
It's lovely. It's not any worse
than me living like a mile away from a dump, but that's another story. Mm.
The other weird phenomenon that I've experienced here is there are some, it's like a cotton storage facility or something like that down the road from where I work. And there's some kind of smell that those places put off. I don't know if it's like cottonseed oil burning or what, but it smells a little bit like steak, but like it's off a little bit. So it like some days, some days it makes me hungry and some days I'm like slightly not like nauseated by it. I don't know what that is, but
that's where impossible meat comes from.
Oh, there's really
no
fun. So see, I don't know anything about impossible meat. So you could have sold me on that. You could have dined out on that joke for a while and I'd be like, oh, wow. Crazy.
Well, that's where I get to mention, why would they call it impossible meat when they could have called it?
Oh no, the joke, the punchline is gone. I believe the word you were looking for Because you texted me about it earlier this week, is Incognito.
That is right. Incognito.
I'll take other ridiculous vegan style puns for 500, please, Alex.
I can't believe I totally blanked on that. The original joke that I've come up with, and I failed it.
Oh, no, that's all right, man. It's going to be only a drop in the bucket because don't forget you're podcasting with me. And I call things thingamabob, and I call actors like whatchamacallit to Megan all the time. She tells me, like, it's a wonder that we can even communicate because half the time you have no idea what you're trying to say.
Just makes it easier for when you're older and don't remember anything anyway.
Yeah, she'll have experience when we're in the nursing home.
So tell me, Chris, kind of moving on, what was your first experience with this album?
So I'm curious how many of our listeners are going to have the same experience that I did, because my first recollections of the song go way back, but my kind of immediate thing that I remember or that I think of when I think of Marty Robbins is the game Fallout New Vegas. Because that game has, kind of a fake radio station, sort of dynamic in the same way that Grand Theft Auto does. And one of the songs that played constantly in that game was Big Iron, the like first track on Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs. And, me and one of my best friends from high school, Max, he was best man at my wedding. We would just hang out at his house and he would sit and play Fallout New Vegas. And I would just like kind of sit and watch because we didn't really have anything to do. And if we were bored of the other games, he would just play that and I'd sit there and shoot the bull with him. And so I remember watching him play the game and loving the music in it. Well, finally, when my wife and I moved here to Lubbock in 2015, we were living with my parents because we had to save up for an apartment and a car because our car had gone the way of all things right before we were going to make the move. And so I would get off work and sit and play this game just to like unwind. And Megan would watch it because it was a really entertaining game and she thought it was fun. But that was like where my knowledge of Marty Robbins came from, because I loved that song. And so I would Google who does this song? What's this guy's name? And so I checked out this album. But I think I have some earlier memories of some of his music, because I remember loving the song El Paso pretty much like since childhood. Mm-hmm. And I think where I heard that song and the song Cool Water, that's another track on this album, of course, are from the Flying J Ranch in Ruidoso, Mexico, or New Mexico. It's one of those places where you go. It kind of reminds me a little bit of like whenever Max and Goofy stop at that like possum ranch in a Goofy movie, except for this place was really good. You would go and they had like kind of a fun little hokey shootout, but then you would go into the dining hall area and have some of the best barbecue I've ever had. Some of the best like ranch style beans and cornbread and like strawberry shortcake or whatever. And you would sit and listen to the Flying J Wranglers, the house band, basically play a bunch of like Western swing music. And they are world-class musicians. So if any of y'all are in Ruidoso, New Mexico, go to the Flying J Ranch, sit through the corny gunfight and go get dinner and the show, because they are top flight musicians. But anyway, I remember them playing Western swing songs, and I would almost put money on it that El Paso and Cool Water were a couple of the tracks that they would play. And I loved that kind of music as a kid. And so the, Fallout New Vegas kind of brought it back to my mind that like, oh yeah, that's a song I really like by somebody whose music I've heard before. So that's kind of my background with this album.
You talking about like chuck wagon dinner places, I distinctly remember several songs from this album being featured in a couple mutual friends of ours, the English Brothers. They were in a Western swing band called the English Brothers, big surprise there, that covered a lot of Marty Robbins music, which is kind of fun as well. But they did the whole chuck wagon dinner barbecue kind of thing out in Fredericksburg for a bunch of years.
And I never got to go to that. I always knew that that Wes did that. Never got to go see him play. I got to play with him a bunch at church, but never got to go see him and his brothers play, which is a shame because he's got a fantastic voice.
And he's a phenomenal bass player and a phenomenal, he is just so good. Yeah. And his brother Gerald plays violin or fiddle and is phenomenal. I worked with Gerald as a graphic designer at Oak Hills for a bunch of years, and he's just a hoot.
Oh, that's so great. This kind of music is really, well, before we get into the album, why don't you give us some background info? Cause this album was kind of interesting to me from the like info perspective.
Yeah. So this album is actually, this album came after Marty Robbins released his first greatest hits album. So he's already a big deal in 1959, when he dropped this album. And it kind of didn't, it was a big hit. It was a phenomenal success for him. It launched him kind of into the common vernacular for 1959 times. And it kind of languished after the fact until it was re-released in 1999 and remastered by Legacy Records and released as a part of a Legacy collection with At Folsom Prison and... I believe it was, which Willie Nelson album was it? Redheaded Stranger. So these three albums were released together and it was a mega hit, like all over the place. You couldn't go anywhere without, you know, hearing it even on the radio again, which was pretty cool.
That's really great.
Especially because, you know, it was almost 40 years old at the time it was re-released. So this album has a lot of staying power because of that. Let's see. It was six of the original 12 songs, which we'll talk about that here in a moment, on the original LP are on the top 100 Western songs of all time. Three of those songs were actually written and performed by Marty Robbins, which is Big Iron, El Paso, and The Master's Call. And then the other three that were written and recorded by others, but the Robbins cover of it is actually the one on the list, which how does that feel? Water, Billy the Kid, and Strawberry Roan. So talk about one album, which in its original cut was only 35 minutes long, having a lot of impact on the top 100 country and Western songs of all time.
I would be curious to know what kind of drove that country renaissance, because those are three albums that you mentioned, Johnny Cash,
Willie Nelson, Redheaded Stranger.
Yeah, there we go.
I forgot it the first time. You can forget it the second time.
Yeah, exactly. We'll just trade off forgetting things. This album is kind of like, I don't want to say they don't write songs like this anymore, because that's like my least favorite point of view that people take is of the good old days. But there is something really inimitable about this album and just the like simple kind of Western swing. So one of the things this album kind of brings to mind is when we did episode 9 about George Strait, he still had some of this Western swing sound in some of his tunes. And I think there's something about that style, that kind of simple storytelling style, that is really, I don't know, it's just something that's timeless to me and that I really like. It was one of the aspects of this album that I really enjoyed. Was just the like kind of jazzy country vibe to a lot of this.
We don't data track this, but from memory, you dragged that album for being way too ballad heavy and gave it like 2 stars. So yeah. How do you reconcile that with this experience?
Well, because these are, I think when you look at ballads, like there's like ballad, the music style, and like ballad, the lyrical form. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the ballads on the George Strait album were ballads in the musical genre, really slower tempo pieces that were really big in scope and orchestral. But like here, like in the title, it says Gunfighter Ballads. Mm-hmm. So it's a ballad, like a, like an epic story or like an epic poem. And that's the kind of like ballad that is interesting to me that happens, I think, in a lot of more traditional country or Western swing. So it's not like Elton John ballad. This is like the Ballad of Buster Scruggs or something like that.
Underrated movie.
Yeah.
I'm going to play devil's advocate one more too. And I'm going to play my hand here and say, I absolutely love this album. So this is really the devil's advocate. Musically, every track on this album is in the same time signature and features the same instruments. How do you...
Well, they recorded this in what, like 6 or 8 hours? It was like one session. They sat down and did this whole thing. And I was thinking about that because it is the kind of thing that normally I would complain about. Like, oh, every song has the same structure and the same instrumentation and the same blah, blah, blah. But I think the context of these songs are kind of important. Like Marty Robbins is playing story songs, and that genre, I think, is just a pretty narrow set of parameters. Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of people who are setting out to reinvent the cowboy song and play it in 7/8 and give it like a swung, like reggae feel, you know, like it wouldn't do. It would be awful. And so I think, I don't know, it's the same kind of thing that makes AC/DC appealing to me. Mm-hmm. Like we've kind of made this joke before, but they released the same album 20 times or whatever, and just like varied the lyrics a little bit. And Bon Scott kicked the bucket so that they had to bring in Brian Johnson. But like, I don't know. It just appeals to me on such a basic level. I almost don't have a defense for like, oh, well, it's like, yeah, you're right. It is super simple, but I just kind of love it.
So here we go with my defense of it, because I'm tired of playing devil's advocate because I'm just so overjoyed that this album finally came up. This is from my list. I love this album and I will die fighting for it. I love the fact, this is terrible for a music podcast, that the emphasis isn't necessarily on the music.
Yeah. Like not every song needs to be like some sort of musically complex opus. I totally agree.
The music supports the story that is being told, and mm-hmm. the music plays a supporting character to what I think is probably one of the greatest lyricists of all time in any genre, regardless of what decade or what is going on. Marty Robbins has the ability to tell a story in a way that makes you feel like the main character of that story, even if you've never had any of those experiences in your life. You feel like Billy the Kid. You may be the most rule-steppingest person on the earth, and all of a sudden, you're worried about the fact they're hanging you tomorrow because, mm-hmm. or wait, let me correct that. They're hanging me tonight because you went out and shot your ex-girlfriend's lover and her as well. Like, it brings you all into that in a way that nobody else does. And we talked about Jack Johnson, or no, I'm sorry, it wasn't Jack Johnson. It was Hozier talking about the fact that poetry and music are totally different things and they don't belong together. Well, mm-hmm. I feel like Marty Robbins is the counterpoint to that. It is the same thing in a lot of cases. And when done right, it's really good. I mean, this album is 62 years old this year, and we're still talking about it, and it still shows up in video games, and it's still part of the cultural milieu, to use a fancy French word, that we have going on today.
Yeah, I think a lot of that has to do with the kind of strange dark art that is lyric writing, because you're not concerned just with words that flow together nicely. Mm-hmm. You're trying to fit in the extra elements of rhythm and pitch. And how can I tell a story using both of those things in addition to just the information I'm conveying? You know, in kind of the same way that when you're filming a movie, you know, you might look at a shot and receive the information of like, oh, these two characters are talking. But if one of them is framed larger in the frame, or, you know, the other person he's talking to, the shot of them, they're shorter in the frame than the person they're talking to. You know, it's those little things, those little decisions that add up to telling a cohesive story. And I think that Marty Robbins is really good at not just putting the information in the song, but making it a melody line that you want to whistle or hum, you know. And he's got melody lines that peak at all the right moments to emphasize moments of the story, and, you know, expositional stuff that is delivered in a way that's not boring or doesn't seem like crowded. Like, that was some of my complaint with Hozier, was I felt like he was trying to cram too many words and syllables into a music line, whereas Marty Robbins just has a knack for conveying all the information in a melody line that still sounds good. He never sounds like he's tripping over his words. And it's just such a special talent that like makes every, like, I didn't get lost in any of the songs on this album. Like, they're all clear as can be with what's going on. And they're also all just like, a lot of these songs are super singable. Mm-hmm. I'd sing along to a lot of these tunes. The ones I've heard the most, I sing along to a ton.
Not only are they super singable, they're all super memorable for the story that they tell. They're
yes.
They kind of have similar themes and concepts, but they're all unique individuals. One of the songs that I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about is El Paso, which is arguably his most famous song. And I joked about it in the lead up to the episode about, you know, going to visit Felina at Rosa's Cantina. Literally everybody, there's nobody who doesn't know that story. But that song kind of was the anchor of this album, was the single that was released. And it was released in two different versions, a album length version and then a full length single, which came out later that year. The single won the Grammy for Best Original Western Song in 1961. The album as a whole won the Grammy for Best Western Album of 1960, and has kind of been, you know, just universally touted as probably the greatest Western song of all time. That top 100 list we mentioned earlier, El Paso is track number one.
No kidding.
So,
wow.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is it actually peaked on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 at number one and was the first hit of the 1960s. It debuted January 1st as a single, and it stayed there for 8 weeks before being supplanted. And the other little random fact I found about it that I just absolutely loved and didn't put in the show notes because I wanted to like see your reaction to see if you knew this. El Paso was frequently performed by the Grateful Dead in concert as one of their break between songs.
No kidding.
Where Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir performed it while the band was resetting.
That is so fun. I love it.
They performed it 389 times from 1969 to 1995. And Bob Weir, in his autobiography, and I believe on one of their albums, mentioned that it is the most requested song that the Grateful Dead play at any event.
That is so cool. I'm going to have to look up a recording of that.
There are several.
I dig the Grateful Dead, too.
So I'd been sitting on that all week. Like when I saw that earlier this week, I almost texted it to you to be like, oh, man. And then I was like, no, oh, I'm saving that.
That's so great. Oh, I have something to look up now. Man, that's so good. You know what? That's a testament to that song, though, because they need something that's going to keep the engagement of the audience, but requires limited musical capability. Like,
are you taking a dig at Bob Weir?
No, I'm just saying, like, there's only two of them. They don't have the, like,
no, I'm just giving you a hard time.
If Bob Weir had any limited musical ability, it was probably just because he was stoned.
And even then, he's probably better than I'll ever be at anything.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he made a career out of it. Yeah.
Being stoned or a musician?
Both, obviously. They created a religion around being stoned, practically. Yeah, but this song, just as an example, I want to find, there's a line in this song. Let's see. Where is it? Let's see. So the main character has ridden back to the cantina after he's murdered this young cowboy, and he's been shot. But my love for Felina is strong, and I rise where I've fallen. Though I am weary, I can't stop to rest. I see the white puff of smoke from the rifle. I feel the bullet go deep in my chest. The like line about the white puff of smoke from the rifle is like one of the most evocative things to me from that song, just because you feel like you could be watching a John Ford Western listening to this song. It's really fantastic. The storytelling is just super good.
A John Ford Western starring John Wayne.
Yeah. John Wayne would be the hothead to shoot somebody and then have to ride off.
And Robert Duvall's like sitting there watching the whole thing. He's the one eulogizing it.
yeah. But one of the things, so we've talked a little bit about the music kind of taking a back seat to the content of the story and the lyrics. One of the things I love about this album is the music, even though it takes a back seat, because the music is all really geared, like you said, towards just getting the story told in a musical way. And I think the biggest component of that is really Marty Robbins' voice. It is so smooth and clear. It's just like butter. Mm-hmm. Like, he never hits a harsh note. He never gets pitchy. He's just completely like delivering these lines like with as much clarity and like soul as possible. But there's nothing distracts from it. You know, that was one of the big things I noticed kind of thinking more critically about this album, is how good his voice is for how little he actually does as a singer.
Yeah. And to keep in mind that this album was recorded basically live as played in like 8 hours, like you referenced, while he was playing and singing at the same time on a 4-track recorder with 6 other guys.
Yeah.
Like how tight of a group this is to have only 6 credited members on an album, and nobody records both their vocals and their playing anymore at the same time, unless it's like a live album.
Yeah, and studio live is very rare.
Studio live is very rare. And here's this guy who makes it sound effortless. Like, his voice is perfect, like you said, just throughout the entire recording. And they pretty much, the order that you listen to it today is not the order it was recorded in. Mm-hmm. But the original LP track list is basically a straight through list of how they recorded the album as they were going through the tracks. So it kind of, his voice tells a continuous story throughout, because towards the end of the day is when they did some of the other, you know, the tireder tracks, if you will, and it kind of plays through well. The album, the recording session started with Big Iron and then led into Cool Water, then Billy the Kid. You know, the next side two started with El Paso after they came back from a break. Like, It all fits kind of this narrative, single linear time flow of their recording session. And it's kind of a bummer we lost that in the re-release. But it's still kind of cool to know, kind of hip pocket.
Yeah, those, and it kind of, when I was doing the research for this, I read like, oh, they recorded in 8 hours. I was like, man, those guys must have been really good. And then I read on a little bit further. The guys who recorded the instruments, they're all part of this group of musicians called the Nashville A-Team. Mm-hmm. And they were huge in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And they worked with everybody.
They were the Muscle Shoals of Nashville.
Yeah. Yeah. I was blown away at who all they mentioned. Elvis, Arlo Guthrie, Johnny Cash, and Lubbock's own Buddy Holly. Mm-hmm. But there are some other, I'm trying to remember some of the other names that I didn't write down, like Bing Crosby. Mm-hmm. These guys had really wide-ranging talents.
If you recorded with studio musicians in Nashville in the 40s through the 70s, these guys were on that recording.
And, you know, it was a lot of fun because even though you could describe the music, the instrumental part of the songs as kind of workmanlike, like really basic, serviceable, but the band is really tight. Like the rhythm playing is really great. All the background singers. So the background singers were really excellent too. Tom Paul and the Glazer brothers. And it was something I wanted to bring up because you hate the one man choir and this album had none of that. No, it was all a group of guys singing and the harmonies on this album are incredible.
And I love the fact that on the album liner notes, they're credited as Tom Paul and the Glazer brothers The Glazer brothers were Chuck Glazer, Jim Glazer, and Tom Paul Glazer. So yeah, there you go.
What magic three trick brothers. Did Tom Paul? Yeah, what did he pull that he got his name out front and his two brothers were just the Glazer brothers?
You know, it had to be something from when they were a child that they were hiding from mother.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, see, here's the thing. I only have one brother. It's me and my younger brother, Timothy, but you were a part of a three brother group. So you probably know exactly what went down or the kind of thing that went down.
But shout out to those guys. You know, I feel like their names deserve to be mentioned because they are so solid throughout this entire experience. And that's Grady Martin on lead guitar, Jack Pruitt on rhythm guitar, Bob Moore on bass, Lewis Dunn on drums, and then the three Glazer brothers as
backup. Look at that. He's already stolen their thunder. Yeah, exactly. The Tom Paul brothers. I wanted to highlight one of the things I love about this genre of music. I keep calling it Western swing because it's kind of adjacent to that. Real Western swing, I think, has like an orchestra element to it, and it sometimes there's that stuff's really fun. But there's a little bit of the same sort of harmonic stuff that you hear in jazz. Now, on this album, a lot of the chord progressions are a little simpler. But Brad Paisley has described country guitar playing as jazz on the back pickup, which for those of you who don't know, the back pickup is the one closest to the bridge on the guitar. So where the strings meet the body of the guitar, that little bar right there that picks up the vibrations of the string, that's the back pickup. That's what you use in country music. And it's a flavor in country music that I feel like gets passed over a lot now because there are so many more influences as far as rock and blues and that kind of thing. But Grady Martin, who you mentioned as the lead guitarist, is fantastic. His playing is so great in all of these because he kind of adds the extra stuff on top that is not just those basic harmonies and basic chord progressions. It's all super jazzy, and he's able to kind of infer some more complex sounds through the licks that he's playing. And the other thing that I wanted to gush about before we move on is correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure he just plays an acoustic on all of these tracks.
Yep.
There's no electric guitar anywhere to be heard.
Correct. On some of his later recordings, his lead guitarist actually played an electric acoustic, but everything on this album is 100% acoustic.
And it just sounds so good, because when you're playing an acoustic guitar, whatever you're playing is going to be the only thing you can do to draw people in. You know, you listen to somebody like Rage Against the Machine or Jimi Hendrix or any of these guys that use a ton of effects pedals. These are talented guitarists I've mentioned, mm-hmm. who can live and die on their acoustic playing. But when you have an electric, you can kind of fudge some things. You can draw people in with the effects that you're using and play something relatively simple. Look at like U2 and The Edge. The guy's playing like two or three notes per song, but because he's got a delay pedal on there and a bunch of reverb and some kind of crazy effect, he creates a piece out of that, which is good. That has merit on its own. But it is super enjoyable to hear somebody like Grady Martin just go to town with nothing but just an acoustic guitar and a pick in his fingers and play just really incredible stuff. And one of the things that I like about the super simple musical approach is each song is basically like, all right, you fill in whenever Marty Robbins isn't playing. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, I mean, I'm not going to say he noodles over the whole thing, because noodling isn't good playing. Noodling is just rambling. But it's one of the like kind of hidden gems on this album is the guitar playing. It's just so excellent.
It really is phenomenal. And it's charming, to use a word from your notes that you actually haven't used too much of yet. Like, it's just, it's so good. It's comforting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit before I alluded to, you know, the smelly scenes of El Paso being one of my earliest memories of this album. But I wanted to talk about why I actually put this album on my list. And it's kind of a personal whatever, but it ties into kind of our family history. My family settled in Texas in the late 1850s, early 1860s. And we moved here from Tennessee by way of, you know, Scotland and Ireland and all those places. Mm-hmm. And we came here when, you know, Texas was a new state and we're on a land grant and settled in what is now west of Brownfield, Texas. They're pretty close to mm-hmm. Lubbock.
Yeah.
In a community that came to be known as the Johnson Farming Community, named after like my great, great, great grandfather, the first person to settle. That's super cool.
Yeah.
And my family lived in earthen dugouts for years out there before they were able to build their first houses and clawed out an existence in the wild, untamed West Texas plains when it was still very much a dangerous place to live. It was very dry and arid, and there was not a lot going for you other than the fact the government was giving away free land out there and saying, turn it into something. And so my family became cotton farmers out there. And to this day, our cotton farming and our farming operations still operate out there in the middle of nowhere. And when our family settled out there in the 1860s, the closest town was a town called Big Spring. Lubbock didn't exist. Brownfield didn't exist. None of those places existed. And Big Spring is 98 miles away from our original homestead out there. And to you and me, that's not a big deal. That's 90 miles down the road. We can do it in, you know, an hour and a half on the wide open highways, no problems. But for my family and for my grandfather in the 1930s, he can remember when his two older brothers hitched up the covered wagon and made the two-week journey to Big Spring by covered wagon, which they made twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall. And they camped out, you know, under the stars and lived the quote-unquote cowboy life, going to town for their once, you know, every 6 months kind of visit, both to prepare for the winter and to prepare for the spring planting season. It's where they bought their seed to plant for farming. It's where they did everything. And it was a huge ordeal. You didn't just drive to the grocery store. There was no grocery store.
Yeah.
And the music of this album ties me to that family history in a way that is more nostalgia than fact, but it still reminds me of where we are today versus where my family was, even in the 1930s. It wasn't until my grandfather, who was born in 1931, was 8 years old, that they actually owned a car capable of making that drive.
Wow.
So it's, and my grandfather wrecked that car, but that's another story for another day.
Oh no.
But the point being, it ties me to my family roots in a way that I remember fondly and think of fondly. And because of that, the music has a very special place in my heart.
I think something that people who don't live in the West kind of miss out on, because I would almost argue that Lubbock, like from Lubbock westward, that's, you're not necessarily in the cultural South anymore. Like you kind of are, but you're in the West,
you're
almost
in the
as much as you are the Southwest, which is really its own thing.
You're not the California West, which is its own thing.
Yes.
The Gold Rush West.
But even out there, and maybe this is a thing I just assigned to Texas in general, but there's such a, you can't help but be kind of tied to or have brought to mind thoughts and feelings about the people who came out and settled. And whether that's a cultural thing because of Western films and shows and that kind of thing, I have always kind of had a soft spot in my heart for cowboys and, you know, cattle hands and that kind of thing. I think in large part because of living in Texas and growing up in Texas. And I think this music is a part of that. And it's a part of that that I really love, because it's music that is so directly tied to history in a way that's not didactic. You know, as much as I love Hamilton, you know, that's not necessarily music born out of like a historical tradition. Mm-hmm. You know, this is music that got its roots in, you know, cowboys writing and playing songs on the trail, and it just evolved as music does. And so that's something I totally get that connection, because you have like real life relatives who went out and, you know, lived the life that is kind of alluded to. And you could make arguments about like, oh, well, it's kind of romanticized. Like some of it is, but that doesn't make it any less like emotionally poignant to listen to this music and think about like, oh, that's, you know, like my people, where I came from, that kind of thing. So I totally get that. Even as a little kid, when we would make the drive from Youngstown, Ohio, where Dad was stationed, all the way down to Abilene to spend Christmas or spend, you know, the summer down here, driving through West Texas, I would always just look and marvel at mesas and mesquite trees and hawks and things. Like it's inescapable, I think.
And now windmills, giant windmills.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Huge honking windmills.
Well, before we talk about critical reception or our reviews or thoughts of it, I wanted to drop another not in the show notes kind of thing, other than I did put in bold, really big in our show note, NASCAR.
Yes, I did notice
that. The other southern pastime. So another thing that really draws me to Marty Robbins and the music of Marty Robbins is Marty Robbins' favorite hobby was NASCAR racing.
And no kidding.
And not watching NASCAR racing.
Oh, he legit raced.
I'm sharing on the screen with you pictures of his cars over the years. He raced.
Oh, man.
He made 35 starts between 1966 and 1982. Coincidentally, his final NASCAR start was actually the week before he passed away from complications from a heart attack and cardiac bypass surgery. Wow. And in his 35 races run over a 13-year span, he had 6 top 10 finishes. And for the listeners listening, he drove really big-bodied Chrysler products like Dodge Daytonas, Plymouths, and then Buick Regals towards the end. And his cars were always hot pink with bright yellow stripes and his name written across the side, Marty Robbins. And he started in the 42 car, the 22 car, and the 777 car when those other numbers were in use. And because of his 6 top 10 finishes in 35 races, that means he had a top 10 percentage rate of almost 18% over his career, which is unheard of for amateur racers who join races. Like, they never do that well. They're always at the back. They finish last.
Oh, wow.
And because of that, to this day, one of his cars is on display at the NASCAR Hall of Fame as you walk into the NASCAR Hall of Fame in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's not a member yet, but it's only a matter of time before he makes the NASCAR Hall of Fame because he popularized NASCAR in the Southwest and West Coast, him being from Glendale, Arizona, actually. So that was kind of cool to get to bring
that
up on this
so
podcast.
That is so funny. Those are great looking cars too. There's one, and you could probably tell me what it is, but the one that has the huge honking spoiler in
the back.
That's
a Dodge Daytona. Yeah.
Oh, that cracks me up. That's so funny. You know, it's interesting. We always associate driving fast cars with rock and roll and maybe now hip hop, I guess. But it's really funny to think of this dude who plays Western swing or like, you know, country and Western just going out there and killing it on the track. That's so funny.
That was his hobby. And I love the fact he called most of his cars. He named each one of his cars, but most of them were some form of a song name. And his most famous one, the one that's on display in the Hall of Fame, is Devil Woman, which is number 777.
Oh, nice. I love it. Well, do you want to move to the critical reception bit?
Yeah, I think it's time. So AllMusic gave this album 4.5 stars on its 1999 re-release, which included 3 extra tracks. Those 3 tracks were the full-length recording of El Paso, which was the single that won the Best Original Country Song in 1961. And then Saddle Tramp and The Hanging Tree were additions. So if you and I followed our normal rules, those would be considered bonus tracks on the original album, even though they're interspersed and not quite correct.
That is the version of El Paso. Is that the one that they tack on at the very end of the album?
Yes.
It's mixed differently.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice it was very like reverby?
It's very
which
different.
I thought was kind of fun.
And it was recorded like 3 months after the original recording. It was recorded as the single for the EP. So
I don't think I realized, maybe I didn't listen close enough, but I think the musicians were so consistent I didn't realize it was a different recording. and part of that might be I'm stuck in the 20th century or whatever, where I'm thinking like, oh, they just slapped some reverb on that. But it's 1959. You don't just slap reverb on something. Like, you got to re-record it, or you, I mean, I'm sure some recording engineering is like, if he's listening, he's probably tearing his hair out at how much I'm getting wrong. But
in defense of that, though, I think that reverb is consistent across all the parts. Like, it's on his voice, it's on everything. Yeah, and so I think what it was they ran it through an actual rack grade effects processor that would have done reverb to the stereo recording of like the post process.
Yeah.
Because it's not just the guitar that has the reverb and his voice is dry. It's everything is equally wet throughout the whole thing. So,
and the other thing I noticed about it is the guitar, the lead guitar stuff is kind of pushed up a little bit more in the mix, which I of course appreciate because I'm always looking for the guitar player.
Yeah. Well, Rolling Stone gave this album a positive review, credited it with being probably one of the greatest Western albums of all time. And it's a re-release we already talked about. It came out with At Folsom Prison by Johnny Cash and Redheaded Stranger by Willie Nelson when Legacy Records focused on reissues for Western music. And all three of those albums ended up going like triple platinum and they weren't sold together.
That's so funny. I'm not surprised at all. All three of those albums are fantastic. And this one, certainly, I think I probably enjoy the most out of all of them, to be honest.
Definitely so. Well, with that said, it's time for us to give our own reviews on this. I think you should go first this week, Chris. To remind our listeners, we use a 1 to 6 string guitar string rating and review system, which is really appropriate for an album that is entirely acoustic and focuses so heavily on guitars. So,
yep,
have at it, Chris.
So my review will not be any great shock to anybody who's listened to the rest of the body of the episode. And if you're skipping everything just to hear our reviews, you're missing out on like 9/10 of what's in the podcast. So
I'll shame be honest, on you. If the episode runs long, I'm just cutting out the reviews because I'm done.
Oh, man. Well, hey, that'll be less work for you. I don't do any work for this podcast. It's I don't know how you've let me get away with basically podcast murder for so long.
You do like 90% of the research. I'm the guy who's like writing my notes 15 minutes before we record. Like, hey, what's up?
Well, to be honest, I do the research like during 15-minute increments. It breaks at work, so I need something to do with my time. But anyway, I've used the word charming more than a few times over the course of making this podcast. If I like it, I'm charmed by it. But I think that for me, with this album this week, the overwhelming experience I had was that I was charmed. That's the word I just felt compelled to use. Marty Robbins is a competent singer. He doesn't have any dazzling chops or range, but his skill is entirely devoted to telling stories through song. And his voice to me is maybe the most charming thing about this album. His voice rings clear like a bell, and I didn't have a hard time understanding it, which is kind of one of my pet peeves. If I can't understand what the singer is saying, and I have to Google it and I feel like it's going to be important to the song, that gets irritating. I didn't have to do any of that. I was just being sung these stories, and I really loved that. And as far as the stories themselves go, these are all really great stories. I think they're all solid. There's a surprising amount of tragedy in some of these songs. People live and die by the gun. Occasionally they're strung up for their crimes. But then also sometimes these people find salvation. Some of the songs are just about people loving their lives. There's kind of a breadth to the experiences on this album. And like I mentioned earlier, these are story songs that remind me of trips to La Mesa and Abilene when I was a kid. It's also impossible for me to separate Big Iron from my experiences with one of my favorite video games. You know, this is a game that I've spent probably far too many hours just sitting and playing. So it's not hard for me at all. This album gets 6 out of 6 strings. Although I will say I'm a little bit more tempted to give it a full 6 bullets in the 6 shooter of your choice, just so long as you use it wisely.
Well, Chris, I am really excited that you had a good experience with an album off of my list that falls in the country genre after some fatal misses for you.
Just one, fatal miss, really.
You didn't like Joe Diffie's Third Rock from the Sun either, so.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I would say the George Strait was okay. Like, there was some of that I really liked. It was just super long. But anyway, I'm relitigating an album in the middle of your review, which is bad podcasting. So please ignore what I've said and go on.
You see what I put up with, dear audience, every week.
He's a saint.
No, this was a very welcome and happy visit under the stars of my open top wagon, drinking coffee and listening to the campfire songs of old while I slowly drifted off into the night. Or maybe I was just rewatching the Three Amigos one too many times and had their parody Blue Shadows on my mind. Seriously, though, this album is one of those albums that gives me more than a glimpse of what country music could be, and dare I say should be, without sounding too much like a gatekeeper for country music. Marty Robbins, the man, has always fascinated me as a kid who loved NASCAR. I was not alive when he was racing, but I saw lots of reruns on ESPN of him racing in the ESPN Classics and seeing that bright pink and yellow car that could not be taken seriously in a sport full of manly men just really solidified him in my mind as just a really cool dude. He's one of those guys that, despite the rhinestones and the polished public persona, was a man's man. And while he did manage a 4-decade-long career, I feel like we were robbed of his talent way too early. He passed away when he was 57 years old. And I kind of like to dream of an alternate line of history where he got to transition into the elder statesman of country music, kind of like Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson have been able to do, and kind of shepherd the next generation of quote-unquote outlaw country, if you will, providing a grounding point for others to launch off of them. And I think we missed out on that. I think he would have been a good representation of what that could be, but we lost him way too early. We didn't mention the guy had 3 heart attacks. It was the third one that finally took him. But for years, he toured with constant heart ailments. Was racing in NASCAR with heart ailments. Like, the guy was just could not be stopped despite all of that. Yeah. You've mentioned it in your review. We've talked about it in the podcast. This is an album full of beautiful stories aided by music that draws you in. Robbins sounds like that one talented friend we all have who would come over to your place with his acoustic guitar and just regale you with songs and tell you stories and just keep you in the moment the whole night through. And this album being 62 years old, when you put it on and you listen to it, you still get that feeling. I definitely had that feeling sitting here in my office and listening to it earlier today. Like, he was right here in the room singing the songs to me, telling me stories that drew me into the storyline itself and making it feel like I was the center of attention and the main character of the song he was telling. I've never been a real cowboy. I've never been an outlaw, but Marty Robbins makes me feel like I could be if I really wanted to be.
If you just believe.
And we talked about his voice and how effortless this sounds. It belies the true genius of the man. The simplicity and the ability to perform this album and record it in a studio quality recording in less than 8 hours with a band and turn out something that we still listen to today and don't go, well, it's great for its time or it's great for what it is. No, it is great, period. And it deserves to be remembered as such and commemorated as much. Because of that, I want more of it and wish we had more of it. And that's one of the reasons I'm kind of bummed that we lost him so soon. This album and this review really makes me kind of fired up. It makes me want to be an outlaw. And to symbolize that tonight, I am going to break the rules of our review and follow through on what you threatened to do. To hell with our six-string guitar review, this album gets a full six rounds of 44 in the big iron on my hip.
Awesome. I love it. I'm ready to go, go right off into the sunset. But before we do that, we have to talk about our favorite and least favorite tracks. Do you want to go first?
Sure. Talk about karma coming back around really quick. Last week, I trashed you for not wanting to pick a favorite or least favorite track when we talked about Mingus Ah-Um. And I even mentioned that that would backfire me as I held your feet to the fire on picking a least favorite.
Yep, yep.
And here we are this week, a mere 7 days later, eating the shameful backfiring carbon whatever.
I believe it's crow or humble pie.
Both of those. It's a crow humble pie.
Ooh, gamey.
I love everything on this album. I've said it in my review. We've talked about it. There isn't a bad track here. They're all timeless classics in my mind. So with that in mind, I'm picking a favorite based on the one that hit me the hardest emotionally at this point in my life listening through it, and that is Utah Carol, which opens with one of the like most quintessentially country western story, like a movie kind of line, and that is... And now, my friends, you've asked me what makes me sad and still, and why my brow is darkened like the clouds upon the hill. Run in your ponies closer, and I'll tell you my tale of Utah Carol, my partner, and his last ride on the trail. This song goes in to talk about, it's a love story about a guy who loves the boss's daughter, and immediately the song sets it up for you to think, like, there's this romantic entanglement between the boss's daughter and this cowboy who the cowboy put a red blanket underneath her pony's saddle so she could ride easy. And the blanket came out while they were driving steers and the steers charged her. And he put himself in the way of the charging bulls and led them off away and ended up being trampled and killed. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful track where you quickly learn that it's not because of romantic love. He keeps referencing the boss's daughter, Lenore, as his little friend, Utah's little friend. And it quickly becomes this story of almost surrogate fatherhood or brotherly love for this, you know, not woman Lenore, but definitely like a child Lenore that he has these feelings for. And that really hit me a lot harder. This song, this album has been in my life my entire life. And this song had never stood out for me before. But listening through the eyes of having my son Maverick, it was almost more than I could handle. And so that's going to be my favorite track right now, and it'll change in a week, but it's the one that meant the most. How about you? What was your favorite?
So my favorite, I kind of went with the basic option. And I feel like if such a thing as a country western hipster exists, they're going to scoff at me for this. But I had to pick Big Iron. I love the story of that song. And I think the melody is really engaging. The driving tempo on the guitar licks set it apart already, but the song has like kind of a little bit of a twist, I would say, because the whole song. So spoilers for a song recorded in 1959, by the way, if you're mad about the spoiler, I don't want to hear about it. I don't care. But the setup is that a big bad outlaw named Texas Red arrives in a dusty little town called Agua Fria, which is a cold water in Inglés for those of you who parle Espanol. But anyway, this outlaw Texas Red shows up to this town and is looking to draw down on a young Arizona Ranger. And Robin spends the whole song talking about, oh, this guy's big and bad and nobody would dare to question him. But when it comes down to High Noon and they've got to draw on each other, the Arizona Ranger, this young Arizona Ranger, is too quick and guns him down and gets his man. And, you know, like I mentioned with that, with Fallout New Vegas, like that song is not only great on its own, but fits the stuff that you do in the game. Mm-hmm. Like whether you choose to be like a good guy or a bad guy in that game,
you're running around gunning people down.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't matter because you're going to be gunning people down either way. And that's what the song is about. And it just kind of typifies that kind of music. I love that song. That I had to re-download this album on my phone because I only had Big Iron and El Paso downloaded on my phone just to save space. But this one is definitely one that gets played heavy in rotation. And since you aren't going to pick a least favorite song, and I'm not going to be mean and make you pick one.
I have one.
All right. Well, do you want to go first? Do you want me to?
Well, it's the same track, but I have a different reason.
Ding, 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 ding. Okay. Well, I'll complain about the song a little bit and then you can. So my least favorite track was The Hanging Tree. It is so god awful cheesy. It is like everything about early 60s, like pop and show tunes just kind of crammed in there. There's that goofy horn call. It's like one of the few instances where something that's not an acoustic, a bass, vocals, or drums appears in this album. And that's super cheesy. There's like a chorus that does background stuff and like a little plunky electric guitar that does like not quite spaghetti Western stuff, but it's stuff you've heard before in like parodies of cowboy movies. But to cap all of that off, the thing it does that is my, like the chief of the seven deadly sins of music is key changes that just go up a step or half a step. Like he'll do a verse with that and then he moves up a key and sings in that key for a little while. And then he goes up one, I think he does it twice in this song and it just bugs the dog out of me. It's like nails on a chalkboard. So that is my least favorite song.
Yeah, and I agree with you both for the cardinal deadly sin being the key change. It's really weird in the song on top of the song doesn't fit the rest of the album. And I thought it was interesting. The song was one of those additional three tracks added to the album in 1999. Was not originally released on the album. It was, however, recorded at the same time as the original album. So it's part of the original recording session. And it's one of the few tracks that was not written by Marty Robbins. It was actually scored by Max Steiner, with the lyrics being written by Mac David and Jerry Livingston, who were two big names in Hollywood in the 1950s and 60s. And this song ended up receiving nominations for a Laurel Award and an Academy Award for its usage in a film in 1960 as Best Original Film Score.
Mm.
But all of that said, it doesn't change the fact that this is the hokiest of the tunes on the album. Mm.
And it's so cornball.
It doesn't fit any of the rest of the album in any way. It's so polar opposite from what the rest of the album is that it's very clearly like spaghetti Western fare compared to true Western fare. And it's almost a parody of itself in a way because of it. And the lyrics just, frankly, the lyrics suck.
And they're so dorky.
It's clear that it isn't Marty Robbins who wrote it when you compare the rest of the tracks here. So without being too mean, it's still a 6 out of 6 album, and I choose to look the other way for that one.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Well, hey, look, before we move on to the Oracle, I wanted to bring up some feedback. Dun-dun-dun. We've got some feedback. Somebody on Instagram who follows us there, Tyler commented about episode 21, the episode Error 404, Page Not Found, about Jack Johnson's album In Between Dreams. And Tyler says, great episode. Thank you, Tyler. I think that the bad French in Belle was the plan. He's a guy who doesn't know French, trying to impress a French girl. It would be weird if he spoke perfect French and then ended it by saying he doesn't understand French, which I thought was kind of a decent point. Like, I don't know if I'm willing to reevaluate my opinion of the song because the French is bad and I just don't like it. But it kind of made me think like, okay, well, at least that song had like more of a direction than maybe I was giving it credit for. What did you think? Yay, nay, eh?
I think it's a great point. When you first sent me the review, because I'm terrible about social media in general, I was kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever. And the more I thought about it and kind of marinated on it, it makes a lot of sense. It doesn't change the fact that it's the weakest track on that album. It's only like a minute 30 long and it has no story. It just ends with, I don't understand French.
Well, yeah.
There are a lot of other languages that you can speak without being able to speak the same word-based language, especially in a love song. Yep. So why don't you tell me about what really happened?
Yeah, I agree. And he even said, like, it's like when we were conversing about it on Instagram, he was like, yeah, it's still not a great song. But yeah. I was thinking
about... He has great taste. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. I was thinking about Hamilton and how when Megan first introduced me to Hamilton, and I don't want to give too much away because hopefully it'll pop up on our list because I know it's on yours. But, you know, I complained a little bit about Lin-Manuel Miranda's voice because I don't like it very much. I don't think he's that good. But his character is also this kind of like unpolished, scrappy guy,
whiny,
and so his voice kind of fits the character, so I can kind of like reevaluate a little bit and go like, okay. But anyway, thank you to Tyler for commenting.
Yeah, thank you so much, man. We appreciate the interaction.
And if you're a fiend for attention in a semi-public forum, comment again, spam the comments and we'll mention it, or we'll complain about you spamming the comments and move on. But either way, you'll get a mention
or you'll be a guest. I mean, come on, at some point, let's get an audience review. We're not.
Yeah, we need a guest. But anyway, that was our feedback portion. Let's go see what the Oracle has in store for us next week.
All right, Chris. So this week, the Oracle is picking from your list, which is 34 albums strong. Let's see what she's got for us. Number 7 is On Dark Horses, Emma Ruth. Who is this?
Rundle. Emma Ruth Rundle. Oh, man, I'm excited about this album. I'm always obvious. I should stop saying that, but I can't keep myself from saying it because these are all albums that excite me. So this is some post rock, some little bit of like noise rock, some kind of Pacific Northwest stuff. I think I'm interested to see what you think of this because this is not. The music is a little moody, but it's not necessarily sad and mopey. Like, it's real driving. It's very intense. So I'm curious what you're going to think of it. This is another one of those that kind of like Phoebe Bridgers' album is one that I heard very recent. It's a very recent favorite of mine. But I don't want to start talking about it too early because I love it.
Well, I definitely tipped my hand. I don't even know the artist's name, let alone the album. So here we go.
Yeah, it'll be interesting for sure.
All right, man. I had a great time talking with you this week. Folks, thank you so much for listening, for interacting with us. We really do enjoy bringing the show to you every week. If you are enjoying the show like we are, please rate and review it on your podcasting platform of choice. We love seeing those and interacting with you on them. And Chris, it's all up to you to head us off into the great horizon in the sky.
Yeah. And if you guys want to get in touch with us, feel free to shoot us an email at twodudesandtunes@gmail.com. And don't forget to hit us up on Instagram the way Tyler did, or Facebook as well. Tell us what you thought of Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs. And don't forget to tune in next Wednesday, where we're off to the races, but this time on a dark horse instead of a hot pink Daytona Super B. Y'all take care.